Welcome back to QT with JC. That's Quarantine Time with Jesus Christ. I'm Max Linville, Campus Minister at the University of St. Thomas in Houston, Texas. Here today with Nicole Labadie, Director of Campus Ministry, and Darnell Miller, Catholic Outreach. And we have an important show for you. Today, as we look into our country, we're reckoning with the sin of racism and a lack of justice. Now, this isn't an easy subject to talk about. We don't expect this podcast is going to change people on the spot. But we do hope that this will lead to thought, dialogue, and consideration that will lead everybody closer to the truth. In part one, Darnell talks about growing up Black and Mexican in America and shares anecdotes from his life. In part two, I talk to Dr. Krista Stevens, Professor of Diversity and Christian Social Ethics at John Carroll University, about racism in an American culture. In part three, who's that saint? We learn about someone who is not quite a saint yet, but is in the process, Venerable Pierre Toussaint. All this is happening right here, right now, so stick around. Part one. Those of you who know him in person already know, but for those of you who have only heard his voice on the podcast, here's some news. Darnell isn't white. He is Black and Mexican, which offers him a unique experience and insight into American culture.
Growing up mixed race in America, it can feel like you're living in a land that was not made for you. I'm mixed race, but not Black and white, the assumption most people make when I mention that I'm mixed, but Black and Mexican, a double minority. Both are groups of people that have been taken advantage of in this country. I was fortunate to grow up in a place that was majority Hispanic, in the Rio Grande Valley in South Texas, right on the border to Mexico. Growing up there taught me a lot about the arbitrariness of borders. In my mind, a border is not firm or resolute because in South Texas, the border was not firm or resolute. The border was a river and a bridge with a slightly taller than average chain link fence, and what it really did was make it slightly more inconvenient to go to the other side. Now, growing up with this idea that the border was arbitrary, that the people on the other side of the border were just like me, really affected the way that I viewed people from other backgrounds. If these people from another country were relatable, then of course those from this country, even if they didn't look like me, were more so. And that's generally the case, but we are a people who love to point out the differences. And for me, that difference was that I was not entirely Mexican. I'm only half. My mother is Mexican. My mom's family has been in that part of Texas as far back as you can go. The border moved over them. We've been there since before America was a country, heck, since before Mexico was a country. But my dad's African American, my dad's Black, and his family was from Alabama, descendants of slaves from the west coast of Africa. They migrated to North Chicago, where my father was born, and that opened me up to a completely different world to the one I grew up in. And growing up in that was an interesting and sometimes challenging thing to navigate, because being Black and Mexican means that I'm neither Black or Mexican. So this idea of who you are gets tied up in who you're around. For the Mexicans, I was Black, and for the Blacks, I was Mexican, and for everybody else, I was an enigma. As a kid, I didn't know how to articulate that. I just knew that I felt different, that I felt other. And that's how racism generally works in America. For most, it's not that blatant attacks or aggressive moments. Yes, those still happen and exist, but it typically exists as death by a thousand cuts. A thousand cuts that can lead to self-doubt, loathing, a lack of confidence, and for a longing to fit in, to not feel other, to feel seen. Growing up, you begin to recognize that there are expectations placed on you because of race. Some things are small, like people assumed I was a good dancer, I'm just okay, and that I'd be good at basketball. I played on the B team throughout junior high and scored a career total of 3 points. But trying to fulfill those narrow expectations, those stereotypes led to an anxiety, to questioning if there was something wrong with me because I was Black and I should be good at those things. On the flip side, there were also expectations of things that we didn't do. When I joined the swim team, a sport I was genuinely good at and loved, I got a lot of comments from people who told me that Black people can't swim. But then when they learned that I was also Mexican, I'd get like, oh, of course, that's why he's a wetback. He swam here. These comments, moments that undercut an individual's experience and desire, have longer lasting effects on the person than any name calling does. In college, I began to examine what being mixed race meant for me, and this is where I discovered that it's a true blessing. I have the occasion to see multiple points of view in this country pretty seamlessly. Growing up American, I embody the deeply American values of hard work, independence, American exceptionalism. But when I watch the news and I see black men murdered, I can empathize. And those men, I see my father, my uncle, my cousin, and it hits me hard. And when I hear how we talk about immigrants in this country, it hits me too, because that's my family. I know them. Being mixed race in America will allow you to see America in a fuller light. It allows you to participate in its joys and opportunities, but you also bear witness and experience those shortcomings. And in seeing that, you are uniquely situated to seek and identify solutions. There are two moments that articulate this well in my life. The first was my senior year of high school. I was in my yearbook class, working on the sports page spreads, when I got paged via the intercom. "Darnell Miller, please report to your counselor's office." In my 4 years of high school, I'd never met my counselor. I never really got in trouble. I got good grades, so there's no reason to see them. So I was confused. I walked into the office, knocked on the door, and peeked my head in. My counselor says, "Darnell Miller?" Yeah, I am. "Okay, good. Well, I'm working on finalizing your transcripts for college, and I need you to pick." "Pick what? Do you want me to put African American on the transcript or Mexican American?" "What? Yeah, you could only pick one. So which one?" I didn't know what to do. How do you pick half of your identity? Why should I have to pick half of my identity? So I called my dad. And my dad, being the practical man he is, asked, "Which one will get you more scholarship money?" I was the only black senior that year. But this need to fit people neatly into boxes is only going to get more complicated as more biracial and mixed race kids are born. The second moment, I was a missionary with Focus, the Fellowship of Catholic University students, and I was at summer training. I remember being with a group of people and somebody was singing a song. I don't know what song it was. And they were like, "Have you heard that?" And I was like, "No." And she said, "So you don't know who John Cougar Mellencamp is?" I didn't. I still don't. Then she says, "Did you even grow up in America?" Now, I take issue at challenging people's Americanness. This is a massive country. Texas itself is bigger than some countries, so discounting somebody's experience of growing up in America because it doesn't align with your narrow experience is irresponsible. If America is a land built by immigrants, it's going to be important for us to learn how to accept others, to appreciate their different lived experiences, and to take the fruits of those experiences and bring them to our collective culture.
Part two. Nicole, I'm sure you've been keeping up with the news, but wow, isn't this an interesting time?
Yeah, I mean, between the coronavirus and the recent incidents of police brutality and now all of the protests, it's kind of a lot to take in and to process.
Yeah, same here. And I think for me, what this has really caused me is to reflect more on my just grad experience and my papers that I wrote. And there's one class in particular that really helped me realize all three of those things are connected and caused by the same thing.
Really? What thing?
Racism. And I know like the coronavirus isn't directly caused by racism, but it does have impacts on communities of color. And so I talked to one of my professors from John Carroll to help me figure out more about this. And her name is
Dr. Krista Stevens.
Her focus is on diversity and Christian social ethics.
As Max said, we met at John Carroll, where I currently teach in the theology department. More specifically at John Carroll, the Anisfield Wolf Teaching Fellow in Diversity and Christian Social Ethics, which is kind of a mouthful.
And we talked about the context of racism in America and how to understand racism in the American culture.
That seems like such a broad topic. So where do we start?
You don't want to walk into class and be like, "Hey guys, we're all racist," right? Like, that's not going to go over very well. And generally, it's not true.
So first, we need to define our terms. What does racism mean?
What I tend to lean on is definitions of racism by a Catholic priest by the name of Brian Massengale. He has this really good and accessible book called Racial Justice and the Catholic Church. A little plug for his book there. I definitely recommend it. But he basically breaks down racism into kind of like two separate understandings. And so he talks about kind of our traditional understanding of racism.
And that traditional understanding of racism is when one person wrongs another solely based on their skin color or race.
Yeah, that's the definition that I'm familiar with and have sort of heard most widely. That's what's led to things like Jim Crow laws and the KKK.
Exactly. But she said, as a society, we have largely moved past that.
And Massengill says, generally, most of us have moved past that approach to people around us, right? So, like, most of us have grown up in households where we're taught that racism is wrong and that everyone is equal and that we should value everyone.
That's great.
Yeah, that is. But that moves us into our second understanding of racism.
And so there's a tendency then to say, well, therefore racism is over, right? We've kind of eradicated racism from our society. We've had this great achievement. And Massengill says, hold on, we actually have to look at this more broadly. And he says, yeah, true. Most people are not abjectly racist, right? That's true. We have made great changes in that regard in society. But he says we have to also look at racism in more of a contemporary way. And here he kind of hones in more specifically on ideas of structural racism or kind of unconscious bias. He calls it covert racism as opposed to overt racism. And his point there is that we really have to pay attention to the ways in which racism has functioned historically in the systems and structures of U.S. society.
This version seems a lot more subtle and a bit trickier to point out.
It is.
So how was this system established or put into place?
We have to go all the way back to the beginning.
So if you start back with slavery, right, obviously that was bad and we have abolished that and that's good. But he says that nonetheless, kind of the after effects of slavery have lingered over the past 250 years. In such a way that people of color are still often disproportionately impacted by health issues, economic problems, job access. I mean, we'll talk more about some of this stuff as well. But his major point is that we've kind of shifted how racism works in our society.
Because Black people are disproportionately affected by health issues when COVID-19 broke out, it was them that felt the brunt of it.
You know, the COVID-19, this health crisis and pandemic really has revealed to us the ways in which people of color often disproportionately bear the burden of social problems, right? And so obviously this is a global pandemic. We've all been touched by it in some way. But people of color disproportionately die from COVID-19. In many cases, or many states and cities, they are infected at higher rates. And so we really have to ask ourselves, why is that?
So why is that?
There are many things we need to look at.
When I was kind of giving us this broader understanding of racism, I talked about things like educational access and economic access and healthcare access. And so I think one of the things this has shown us is that there's lots of things going on.
So let's start with healthcare access.
People of color often are more likely to be uninsured or underinsured. They're more often likely to not have access to quality healthcare. Those who do have access to healthcare, are less likely to be diagnosed correctly by doctors, particularly white doctors. Not for any nefarious reason on the part of doctors, right? It's just it's just this long history of how Black bodies have been viewed.
And there is more still.
People of color are more likely to have comorbidities, so things like diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, all of these health care issues or health issues disproportionately affect people of color.
Now, it is easy to look at this information and think that Black people are just less healthy, and that's why they have those issues. But it goes deeper than that.
I think we have to look at bigger pictures of what kind of jobs people of color have, where people of color live. So they tend, with exceptions of course, often tend to live in more urban areas, which are more condensed, right? So social distancing becomes a lot harder when you're in a city. I mean, just look at New York, for example, right? Part of the issue there was that so many people lived in such a small space that it was hard to really to separate yourselves out. So that's part of it. What kind of access to food sources that people of color have. In many urban areas, there's what we would call food deserts, right? There's sometimes not access to nutritious and affordable food, which can contribute to things like high blood pressure and diabetes.
We also need to look at education access and what effect that has.
Early in this pandemic, there were rumors going around in some Black communities that Black people couldn't catch COVID-19, which is patently false, right? And so all of these things kind of came together in this perfect storm to really impact communities of color in ways that we had not seen in a really long time.
Wow. So how did it happen that Black people ended up in these urban areas?
That was through illegal practices like redlining and blockbustering that made that a reality.
Post-World War II, I guess, middle of the 20th century, we see, first of all, a lot of migration of Black communities from the South, which historically has had higher populations of people of color just because of the legacy of slavery. Post-World War II, and even during World War II, moving north, the economy was booming. There were lots of jobs in urban areas and cities in the Northeast and Midwest, factory jobs, jobs that you could obtain without an education or a college education that were pretty well paying. And so I think there was this sense of opportunity in many of these cities.
So as people moved into those cities, two things happened.
On the one hand, we also saw a response of white flight. So white people began moving out of those communities, primarily because of racism, right? Fears that property values would decline, or that schooling would be, the educational system would decline, all those kinds of things.
And the second was redlining.
The ways in which real estate agents and property owners and landlords kind of rented and sold property illegally, right, tended to create sections in these urban areas where they would not sell to people of color, right? And so that created kind of pockets in these urban areas of communities of color. So that's part of it. There were just places where they just would not lease an apartment to a person of color or sell a house to a person of color.
Now, as Catholics, we bring something to the table to help us think about all these issues.
Catholic social teaching.
Exactly.
First and foremost, we've been throwing around this phrase Catholic social teaching, and if your listeners are unfamiliar with that, it's basically the church's social teachings on social issues, right? Issues of larger social justice. But kind of the foundational principle of Catholic social teaching is the human dignity of each and every person as beings created by God, right? So if you go back to the very beginning of scripture, we see right away, first of all, God is the creator of everything, right? Everything. And if we were to read through Genesis, through each step of the way, God looks at God's creation and says, this is good, or I am well pleased. And so it signals to us that God's creation is fundamentally good. And then we get to the creation of humans, and it says, right, God says, let's create humans in my image. And so that places a fundamental dignity in each and every person, regardless of race or ethnic background or orientation or geographic background, all of that, right? All kind of this fundamental equality.
As you know, that is the fundamental stepping stone to Catholic social teaching.
But then we also realize that even though we're created in God's image, we're also fallen. We don't live in a perfect world. And so throughout history, different injustices have arisen.
So the second step is the preferential option for the poor.
So when we're talking about preferential option for the poor, we're certainly not saying that God prefers some people over other people, right? We're not saying that. We're not saying that poverty is good in any way. We're not saying that either. How I like to explain it to my students in class is to consider, if they have siblings, to consider a time when one of their siblings was sick or injured, right? Maybe your brother or sister broke their arm or something like that. And I ask them to think back to, in those moments, who got more of your parents' attention? And they always say, well, my sibling, of course. And I ask them why. And they all say, well, of course, because my brother or sister needed more care and attention in that moment, right? And they recognize that it's not because their parents loved the sibling more than them, or didn't like them, but that in that moment, the sibling had a need that warranted greater attention and compassion and concern. And so when we're talking about preferential option for the poor, that's what we're talking about, right? The people who are suffering from injustice or poverty or lack of access to things that give us a quality of life, education, healthcare, food, housing, those kinds of things, deserve special attention, right? Again, not because they're more important or better than anybody else, but that their needs are such that they need our compassion. And so those are kind of the two ways I would go about kind of addressing this issue of racism.
A good example of this is Saint Oscar Romero. He was a bishop in El Salvador during a time of brutal oppression of a military regime. And basically they were persecuting the poor and the farm workers in this country. And Saint Oscar Romero at the time was the archbishop, or was the bishop, became archbishop, but he was looking at this issue, and he generally was just a product of what he was raised up in. He was with the wealthy, and he really just kind of spoke and worked with the poor, but never for the poor. He would help them out when he could, but it never was like impacting his heart or moving it. And then he had a profound conversion. And when you look back at his life, there's multiple things that kind of led up to this, but this conversion has moved them away from this prestige and power to start being with the people and work more proactively with them. And what he started to do, he started to go out into these communities of suffering and started to listen to them and bring their voices to the table with him. And he started to educate himself on their suffering and what was going on in these areas so he could speak more justly and more for those people. So that's really this conversion that he had, that it was a conversion to be with the people, and his heart was moved by this.
So how do we start to have that conversion of heart like Oscar Romero did?
So for me, it started with service. I remember when I was in high school, I heard this guy called Doc Henley speak about water issues in the world. And I was like, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to work with the water and help people get clean water. And then after that, I kind of did that for a little bit, but something led me to a more encountering style of service. And that was at my time at Holy Cross College. I remember one year in particular, it was my sophomore summer going into my junior year. I spent time in Detroit, Michigan, in this area called Mexican Town, Detroit. I was a baseball coach there. And at that time, if you knew anything about just what was going on with immigration, there was all this stuff talking about how they illegally crossed, Mexicans illegally crossed over, they're taking jobs, and the media was really portraying this as that the Mexicans were the others and that we needed to fight against them from taking over the American society. And through my encounter of just service with the young adults and the kids there, really changed my whole perspective. It tore down those prejudices and those walls that I kind of built up just through what I was being exposed to on the media, and it really open my understanding of how it's not, this is not what it is. Like, they have an innate human dignity. It helped me see the human dignity behind the whole person and the whole issue. And it really changed my perspective on just like what was going on with the immigration issue in our country, and really brought to light that that we just need to encounter each other and start to see each other as human beings. And this has kind of led through all my service experiences through my time in Cleveland when I was working with the Famicas Foundation in the urban area. And I was working at a Section 9 housing area, and I was doing young adult programming, and just working with the Black community there really changed my perspective on what was going on in the American cities. And then also in my time in Jamaica, there's all these experiences and encountering each other has really transformed my understanding. But it doesn't always look that way for everyone. It doesn't have to start with going to encounter. It can come from a different viewpoint of just educating yourself on the issues and then going out. But there has to be some point when we go out and meet the people where they're at.
I can relate to that, that conversion of heart and really getting more into my faith happened largely through encountering others through service and simply building relationships with people whose experiences differed than my own. But how about life during COVID-19? And if service, like physically being with people, isn't an option because of social distancing, what else can we do?
One unique thing I have seen is advocating for legislation. So CRS does this and Catholic Charities does this, but there's one unique thing that happened recently in Cleveland, Ohio, which declared racism as a public health issue.
What's really interesting about this is the City of Cleveland Council drew on guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and the World Health Organization that classifies certain things as public health crises. So like COVID would be a public health crisis. The AIDS pandemic was a public health crisis, Ebola, all these kinds of things. And what's interesting about these categories is it identifies a large scale issue that negatively impacts the health of certain communities. And once that's identified, then resources are put into place to eradicate that health crisis, right? And so, I mean, it took a while, but we saw with the AIDS pandemic, eventually, right, doctors were able to come up with drugs, right, that really improved quality and longevity of life of people infected by HIV and AIDS. And so I think the idea here is, if we identify racism as a public health crisis that negatively impacts education, health outcomes, economic stability, then we can put the resources needed to begin to address those larger systemic issues to create a better quality of life for communities of color so that they won't be as disproportionately affected by things like COVID, for example. And so I think this is a really cool approach of using standards that are already there, right? And applying it to a real life situation of disparity and burden. And so I do think, now again, this is in its early stages, so we'll see how it goes, right? But I do think it's something that other communities should be looking at. And so I'm very hopeful that this will kind of spark something, hopefully nationwide, but definitely in the state of Ohio, to really begin to address these racial disparities.
Part 3. Who's that saint?
Venerable Pierre Toussaint was born a slave in 1766 in Saint-Domingue, the French colony which is now Haiti. He worked as a house slave inside the plantation owned by the Berard family, and was educated by the family's tutors, which was really unusual for the time. The Berards moved to France, leaving the plantation and Pierre to their son Jean Berard. In 1787, Pierre and his sister Rosalie moved to New York City with Jean Berard to escape the political unrest on the island. In New York, Pierre was allowed to train as a hairdresser, and he earned his own money and became increasingly successful as a hairdresser. Jean Berard returned to Saint-Domingue to look after his properties, leaving Pierre to watch over his wife, Madame Berard. Shortly thereafter, Berard passed away due to illness, and Pierre voluntarily took up the support of Madame Berard until she remarried. On her deathbed, she made her husband promise to free Pierre. He was 45. Now, due to connections among the French immigrant community in New York, Pierre met people who knew the Berards in Paris and began correspondence with them that lasted for decades, particularly with Aurora Berard, who had been his godmother. The Berards lost their fortune during the French Revolution. He also corresponded with friends in Haiti, and his collected correspondence filled 15 bound volumes. Pierre did well as a hairdresser, serving the wealthy of New York. He purchased the freedom of another slave, Juliette Noel, and they married and adopted a daughter. From very early on, the couple were very conscious of the needs of the poor. They opened their home to orphans and as refuge to those in need, and assisted them in getting an education and learning a trade. Many Haitian refugees moved to New York too, and because Pierre spoke both French and English, he frequently helped new immigrants. He was also renowned for crossing barricades to nurse quarantined cholera patients during an epidemic in New York. Pierre lived in an era where not only was he looked down upon as a freed slave, but anti-Catholicism was strong in New York at the time. But that didn't stop Pierre from professing his Catholic faith. He attended Mass every day for more than 60 years and was devoted to the Rosary. He was a benefactor of the first New York City Catholic school for black children. In addition to helping others with money he made, he gave a great deal of the money to help finance the construction of the original St. Patrick's Cathedral on Mulberry Street. A story is told that on the day the cathedral was dedicated, Pierre went to the church for the celebration, but because he was black, an usher would not allow him to enter. As he was being turned away, another usher, recognizing him, immediately brought him in. When Pierre died in 1853, he was buried in the cemetery of the cathedral. But in 1990, the cardinal in New York had his remains moved to the crypt in St. Patrick's Cathedral, where only cardinals and archbishops are buried. Pierre is the only layperson to be so honored. In 1950, the John Boyle O'Reilly Committee for Interracial Justice, an Irish-American group devoted to social justice for blacks, began researching and publicizing Pierre's life story. Because of his reputation for great charity, Cardinal Terence Cooke, then Archbishop of New York, authorized the formation of a canonization committee to further study. Based on their findings, in 1991, his successor, Cardinal John O'Connor, strongly supported Toussaint for sainthood and began the official process, according to him the title of Servant of God, the designation given to those in the beginning stages of being investigated for canonization. In 1996, Pope John Paul II declared Pierre Toussaint venerable, the next step towards sainthood.
If you made it this far, thank you for sticking with us. This whole project is a labor of love, but we want to hear from y'all. How are systems of racism present where you live? How will you live out our Catholic social teaching for the benefit of all? Let us know. Hit us up on social at Kelp Campus Men on Instagram and Facebook. Share this with your friends, family, coworkers, classmates, the one person who's the most different from you. They are still made in the image of God. And a special thanks to Dr. Stevens. Thanks for taking the time to break down this important topic. To learn more about what we talked about today and how you as an individual can move into the realm of action, we have a resource list for you in our Instagram bio, at Kelp Campus Mid. You've been listening to QT with JC. I'm Max Lindell. Until next time, peace.